Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you, Cup, for coming out on such a miserable day. It's a day for the ducks, and I hope that you've all got here safely. It's my great pleasure today to welcome back to the Parliament Dr. Scott Brenton. He was here last year as the Australian Parliamentary Fellow attached to the Parliamentary Library. And during the time that he was with us, he did all sorts of interesting research, including lots of surveys and interviews with members and senators. He's a political scientist, and he's one of those quantitative political scientists in some ways, so that he does things with numbers in a very interesting way. Today he's going to talk to us about the work that he did last year, from which he produced his monograph, What Lies Beneath, the Work of Senators and Members in the Australian Parliament. But as you'll see from our publicity, he's put a very contemporary spin on his research. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Scott Brenton.
Thank you, Rosemary. Belated congratulations on your appointments to the clerk. And let me also note my appreciation of your departments, as you and your colleagues were very supportive in helping undertake this research in Parliament last year. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land we are meeting on, the Ngunnawal people. And when I presented this work as a work in progress over a year ago, I added that I look forward to the day when Indigenous and other underrepresented Australians sit in our national parliament. And of course now, finally, over a century of Australian parliamentary democracy later, an Indigenous Australian, Ken White, the member for Hasluck, has been elected to the House of Representatives. And this is a theme that I'll be revisiting throughout the lecture. What is representative democracy and what does it mean in practice? Indeed, as I look back on my notes, I reflected on how much has actually happened in Australian politics over the past year. In the last few years at many universities, international relations and international politics were seen as the sexy fields in political science. But this year there was a spike in Australian politics enrolments. At the start of my first year subject, I told the students that they would often hear the cliche that a week is a long time in politics. Given that there was likely to be an election held in the year and the class comprised mainly of first-time voters, in the major essay I asked them to predict who would win the federal election and what the result would be. Now, this was in March or in April of this year, and almost every student, no matter what their political persuasion was, predicted that Kevin Rudd would win in a landslide. But by the end of the subject in June, and I'm talking about the day before the final exam, no one was standing by that prediction, with Rudd no longer a contender. Fortunately for me, and I'd written the exam a few months ago, there were no questions on who is the Prime Minister or explicitly referring to Rudd. But during that period and in the post-election commentary, it was embarrassingly clear how little we as a country know about our political system. How dare those faceless men stab the Prime Minister in the back and take him out? The Prime Minister that we elected as the people. Coincidentally, in my presentation last year, I looked at some very basic voting statistics to make a different point. But as it turns out, the personalities are very relevant here. I noted that we, in the broader sense, don't ever elect the Prime Minister. And at the 2007 election, only 43,957 Australians voted directly for Rudd in the electorate of Griffith. By contrast, at that same election, 1,760,022 Australians voted for Senator Mark Abib, who does actually have a face and led the Labor Senate ticket in New South Wales. But I digress from the central point, the myth of this popularly elected Prime Minister, propagated in large part due to our presidential-style election campaigns. So we have this myth that we have a popularly elected Prime Minister, that we have a single chief executive who has a three-year term of office that can only be terminated or extended by the people at an election. But that's not our system. And that's never been our system. Presidents have such a tenure, prime ministers do not. And the change of prime minister demonstrates that ours is a proper Westminster-derived parliamentary system. That works for two main reasons. Firstly, the executive is ultimately accountable to the legislature, albeit imperfectly due to strict party discipline, but the executive must retain the support of the legislature, which in practice was the Labor caucus. Secondly, the executive should be collective, with the Prime Minister first amongst equals. Now, I don't mean to engage in an extended critique of the former Prime Minister, other than to say that normally Cabinet should be doing things differently behind the scenes. But if it gets to a point where they feel that the government has lost its way, or that they, as the equals in the collective executive, are being sidelined, then they should act as they did. None of this necessarily lessens the shock when it does happen, and of course it can be argued that it shouldn't have got to the point that it did, but it is a crucial accountability mechanism. And one positive was that we finally got a female Prime Minister in government without having to go through that tired old debate that would have dogged a female opposition leader attempting to win government. Is Australia really ready for a female Prime Minister? Well, Australians have long been ready. It's the media and the faceless men in both major parties that haven't been. But focus groups finally told them as much. It's almost hard to believe that Julia Gillard had to battle for pre-selection and was initially relegated to the third position on the Labor Senate ticket at the 1996 election. It wasn't a winnable position, but she was almost elected. Imagine Senator Gillard now. But she probably would have been a very effective senator, as she showed as she guided the government's workplace relations legislation through what is known as a hostile Senate. And I want to return to this term later. But a Senate where the opposition actually had a majority for the first few months of the new Labor government before the Greens and an independent and a family first senator held the balance of power. Another strange term that I will come back to. Now, Gillard talked tough to the media and stridently sold a more uncompromising government position to stakeholders and to voters, but behind the scenes briefed any senator who would listen and negotiated and amended and even sat in the Senate at crucial stages. Now, that's been the norm for the past three decades, bar 3 years of coalition majorities in both houses, which incidentally coincided with coalition senators themselves crossing the floor. And shock horror, legislation has got through during all of those periods, governments have been stable, and markets haven't crashed because of it. Sure, government is formed in the lower house, but as we have known since 1975, governments can be unformed by the Senate. But that hasn't happened since. Even when left-wing parties have had the numbers in the Senate, while right-wing parties have governed. It's actually not the minor parties and independents that are hostile and threaten to bring down governments, because they are far less secure in their own positions and usually eager to serve as long as possible and extract concessions from being in those positions. It's usually oppositions that fall into the hostile category, whatever the colour, but the opposition cannot unilaterally bring down a government anyway. There might be a by-election during this term, but often by-elections are caused by retiring members who suddenly realise the need to spend more time with their families, yet didn't act on that thought a few months earlier before nominating and contesting election for a three-year term. But that's not likely to happen in this term. And even if there is a by-election, it won't necessarily be caused by a government member. And even if it is, it might not be in a marginal seat. And even if it is, voters will well be aware of the stakes and arguably far less likely to punish a government just because they can. Of course, this isn't going to stop media speculation, as was the case post-election. Who has the right to form government? Is it who won the most primary votes or the two-party preferred vote? Well, the answer to these questions are the same as they've been after every single election. The members of Parliament, and I won't be provocative at this point and include senators, even though that is theoretically possible, but for simplicity, the members of the House of Representatives decide amongst themselves who will serve as the Prime Minister. The major parties have decided that there should only be two candidates for that position, and the members of their parties will automatically support them. It was just after this election that the major party leaders couldn't just phone each other and concede or give victory speeches on election night, but they actually had to talk to other elected members of Parliament and outline a plan for the next 3 years. Now, this might shock some traditionalists, but traditionally, leaders have actually outlined what they plan to do during the actual election campaign and properly cost their policies. This time, they actually had to talk to people outside of Western Sydney and Queensland. They had to remember that there are more voters elsewhere in places like Melbourne and Hobart and Port Macquarie and Tamworth. And talk they did for 17 days. But how to report this? How could the 24-hour news channels and internet news sites provide an hour-by-hour, blow-by-blow account that we were all so used to? By speculating, of course, and invoking fear and loathing. What do we do if no one can form a government? Is the Governor-General compromised? How dare the independents take 17 days to decide? Why is it taking the Electoral Commission so long to calculate the two-party preferred vote? How is it possible for a minority government to actually work? Well, if you think 17 days is a long time, spare a thought for the poor Belgians or the Dutch. It took about 4 months for the Dutch politicians to conclude a workable coalition agreement in order to govern. The Belgians went to the polls well before us in mid-June and are still in caretaker mode. So 17 days is nowhere near being a record, albeit Rob Oakeshott's speech in announcing his addition might be a record. As for minority government, we here in the ACT know that's normal. And there's currently also minority Labor governments in Tasmania and the Northern Territory, and a minority Liberal government in Western Australia. Incidentally, the most unpopular governments are arguably in the other states where there are majority governments. Currently, other Westminster-derived parliamentary democracies, including the United Kingdom, Canada and New Zealand, have coalition or minority governments where a major party is not able to govern with a majority in its own right, which is also the case in many, many other countries. A few years ago in Germany, when neither of the two major parties won a majority, they decided that the easiest coalition was with each other, and they formed a grand coalition, which has also been a feature of other countries throughout history. So let's just get a bit of perspective here. As for the Electoral Commission, part of the reason why it took so long to calculate the two-party preferred figure and why it changed so dramatically as seats were suddenly included or excluded is that we persist with the assumption that only two parties are the contenders, and that isn't the case anymore. And I think this was what was underlying the shock, that Coke and Pepsi are no longer the only flavours of cola, and that cola can even come in other colours. Now, I'm not about to predict the demise of the major parties or the end of the adversarial two-party dominated system, but rather acknowledge that this moment has been a long time coming. Many of these independents are not new phenomena. The collective parliamentary experience of Oakeshott, Windsor and Katter across state and federal parliaments exceeds that of Gillard, Swan and Abbott. One independent has even been in this situation before in New South Wales. Independents only have the balance of power because the majors oppose each other. But the real power is with the parliament and all parliamentarians. Any other members could have chosen to be part of the negotiations, but most pledge allegiance to a party. And fair enough, they campaigned for, were supported by, and were elected as representatives of parties. But don't complain when other parliamentarians who don't have such allegiances and without the considerable financial and organisational support of parties, win seats and then attempt to secure concessions for their electorates and constituents. Any other parliamentarian could have done that. Any parliamentarian in the new parliament can choose to judge any piece of legislation on its merits and propose amendments. Now, I'm not actually against parties or even the major parties, but rather the ridiculously strong and uncompromising party discipline that isn't a feature of Westminster or Washington. Of course, members of the same party are probably going to agree 99% of the time, but is it really necessary to force 100% submission? It's interesting that Australia has such tight party discipline and yet is home to more independents than any other comparable democracy. Every state and territory in Australia has had minority governments, and as I mentioned before, governments have had to take notice of the Senate, which they have generally not controlled. The government now has to negotiate with crossbench members of the House of Representatives as well as senators. And my question is, so, does that really change anything? This is by way of a long introduction to my previous research conducted here at Parliament House last year as a parliamentary fellow. Now, I'm really out of my comfort zone here, as I normally cannot speak without the psychological crutch of PowerPoint and a clicker in my hand, but I have left all of the graphics and pretty graphs and stats out today and will instead just give a plug for the written monograph, which is available for purchase at the parliamentary shop, But I'm not receiving royalties. You can also freely download it from the Parliamentary Library website, as well as a paper on independence, which was co-written with Dr. Mark Rodriguez. So that's my advertising for the library out of the way, and I should also acknowledge the support of the Joint Standing Committee on the Parliamentary Library, especially the Joint Chairs, the Honourable Dick Adams and Senator Russell Trude, because they actively encouraged their colleagues to participate, and I wouldn't have got the response I did without them. And also a special mention to a new doctor, Dr. Tony Lamb, who corralled even more former members and senators to participate through a mass mail-out. And as much as I like to get stuck into politicians, Tony is one of the many politicians who still feel a strong sense of wanting to make a contribution. And many current and former members and senators were extremely generous with their time and insights. Now, observations and arguments are based on a survey of 233 current and former parliamentarians, which represents a credible response rate of almost 40%, and a further 29 in-depth interviews with selected prominent politicians. And I targeted politicians from different parties, different states, parliamentarians that had served in two houses of parliament, et cetera, et cetera. What I'm most interested in is what's the difference between the Senate and the House of Representatives? Or more precisely, what's the difference between senators and members? I proceeded from the assumption that outsiders don't really know what politicians actually do. What does their job involve? What is the typical, if there's such a thing, day like? What makes a good representative? What I was surprised to find was that insiders, that is the parliamentarians themselves, also don't have a particularly good or accurate perception of what their colleagues in the other chamber actually do. For those of you who have done the tour of this building, you would have noticed that everything is nice and symmetrically divided, with the senators and senators on one side and the House of Representatives and its members on the other. As one interviewed parliamentarian who has served in both houses sharply observed, and I quote, "The chambers are only about 70 metres apart, but it could be a kilometre," end quote. Senators and members, along with, I might add, departmental officers, lightheartedly referred to each other and the other side as the dark side. But beyond jokes among the occupants, it's been the Senate that's copped the most ridicule. Former Prime Minister Paul Keating famously derided the Senate, and again I quote, "a spoiling chamber, usurping the responsibilities of the executive drawn from the representative chamber," end quote, while ridiculing senators' unrepresentative swill. Others have described the Senate in equally unflattering terms, including a retirement home for time servers, a comfortable home for old men with their weak, arthritic wrists and wheezing voices. Yet the modern Senate slowly became more representative of the wider populace than the House of Representatives. The first two Indigenous Australian parliamentarians were senators, although the House is catching up. However, women only occupy a quarter of the seats in the House, but over a third of the Senate seats, although, of course, as mentioned, the most important seat is now held by a woman. While the youngest women to be elected and sit in the parliament were senators, a 20-year-old first-time voter now sits in the House. The first Australians of Asian ethnicity to enter parliament were senators, although now there is a Muslim member. In the last parliament, the only openly gay and lesbian politicians were senators. There are a number of other minorities that have found a more comfortable home in the Senate, including, again until recently, minor parties such as the Greens, which has become the first minor party to win a seat in the House at a general election in the post-war period, although they'd previously won a seat through a by-election. Part of the reason why a more diverse range of candidates have been able to win elections of the Senate is due to the different electoral system. The system of proportional representation that roughly allocates seats in proportion to vote share. And with a minimum hurdle of about 14% as opposed to 50% for House seats, senators have found it easier to be elected. At every Senate election since 1955, candidates from outside the Labor, Liberal and National parties have been elected. Minor parties and independents have held this thing called balance of power from 1981 to 2005, and again since 2008. Cautious using this term, again because it's only a construction. Any senator could theoretically exercise such power on any issue, but again I digress. While minor parties have traditionally been more electorally successful in the Senate, there have been more independents elected to the House of Representatives. But again, this is changing. The Greens have broken through an important psychological barrier and actually finished second in another two inner city, formerly very safe Labor electorates. And while it is premature to predict the end of majority Labor governments, Labor also governing with Green support in Tasmania and here in the ACT, and Labor should be concerned about their longer term prospects. But I do qualify this by also noting that in recent times where Labor have governed at a state level with independent support in Victoria, Queensland and South Australia, they have gone on to thumping majorities at the next election. But one important difference were these were all first term Labor governments. So it is more complicated, but Senate experience suggests that this is only the beginning. Once upon a time, it was rare for minor and independent senators to clear the minimum hurdles without preferences. But now senators like Nick Xenophon, Bob Brown, Christine Milne, and an increasing number of Greens are winning quotas in their own right. They are becoming less dependent on major party preferences, while Labor at least is finding it harder to win lower house seats without Green preferences. In the House, savvy independents and minor parties, and also voters, have realised that while the electoral barrier may appear higher, our system of preferential voting can be beneficial. Provided one of the majors is pushed under 50%, finishing ahead of the other major with 20 to 30% of the primary vote can almost guarantee election, as the majors are still playing the two-party game and putting each other last. And when independents win, they too enjoy the benefits of incumbency, and can often go on to very comfortable majorities, so they are doing something right. Who knows what will happen to the independents who supported the Labor government, but looking at the results, they can suffer a massive swing and still comfortably retain their seats. And again, to the commentators who were trying to make sense of what the constituents thought in two-party terms, while they may be conservative-leaning seats, this ridiculous line of argument that only majorities voted Labor in those seats is because many are now voting independent first, and the majority have rejected both majors. And even if there are changes in those seats, I wonder how many other voters in other seats will now think, our local hospital is also in need of an upgrade. Maybe an independent could achieve that. And while it may be derided as pork barrelling or bad public policy to get to privilege certain seats, and I do agree, on the other hand, this is politics and has been for so long. If you want to get noticed, get ministerial visits, get the local infrastructure funded, make your seat marginal. That's how the majors create their election campaigns. In the Senate, former Tasmanian Senator Brian Harradine was very effective in winning concessions for his state and also furthering his social agenda. Again, this is not necessarily a good process for making public policy, but there is something in the idea of all representatives vigorously pursuing the interests of their constituents and through that collectively determining the national interest. In this new paradigm, there are already moves, particularly in the government, to involve the backbench more in policy development, because at a base level, a disgruntled backbencher now potentially has a lot of sway. And this is how it should be. This is actually a Westminster system, and a very important link in the chain of accountability, that of the executive to the legislature and backbenchers scrutinising the front bench. While the Senate has responded to criticisms of laziness and irrelevance and evolved into one of our most important institutions for ensuring accountability of the executive through innovations like Senate Estimates Committees, the House hadn't been able to shake the tag of being an echo chamber of the executive. Now, all members actually have to turn up to proceedings. I remember during my interviews that were generally conducted during parliamentary sittings, and therefore the bells would often ring mid-interview, members would often simply check their pager and continue as they were rostered on at certain times, while senators would often have to leave, and it was much harder scheduling senators during those times. Many members confided, and this also came through the survey data on how members and senators spent their time, that sitting in Canberra are in some ways welcome opportunities, free from the usual constituent demands and public ownership that they felt in their electorates. And I'm not saying this is a criticism at all, because as a member, every night could easily be filled with a school speech night or a community meeting or fundraiser and fairs and sports events on the weekend. But by comparison, Parliament was a sanctuary, political resort if you like, a coffee with friends at Aussies, a swim in the Parliament pool, a hit on the tennis court, even room service lunch at your office. And if you miss a vote, legislation still gets through. okay, there's some artistic license here, but there was definitely a sense that parliamentary sittings are much more stressful for senators than members. And conversely, and just as legitimately, during non-parliamentary sittings, there was much more pressure on members than senators. The outcome of legislation could change if a senator missed a vote, and in between chamber work, committee work was very important and time-consuming, while lobbyists and interest groups all wanted the attention of senators, especially the crucial swing votes. Members have already started to feel this, but it does come with some other positives. We've already seen some parliamentary reform, always promised by oppositions but never delivered by governments. While it remains to be seen whether the standard of question time will improve, the Senate is testament to the fact that the overall quality of debate will likely improve. If only simply because the executive can no longer have its own way and rush through legislation and shut down debate, it will have to convince legislators and be open to negotiation. The few parliamentarians that I spoke to or surveyed who have served in both the Senate and the House generally agreed that the standard of debate was better in the Senate and that courtesy and respect were more forthcoming and petty name-calling less, although not absent, but less of an issue in the Senate. Senators from all sides, particularly current ones or recently retired ones, felt a much greater sense of excitement and interest in the work of their chamber than their colleagues in the House. Despite the fate of legislation often being decided by the Senate, it's been the House of Representatives that has been considered the main game in politics. That is, after all, where government is formed, where the Prime Minister, Treasurer and opposition leaders sit, where most ministers sit and snippets of question time from the House appear on the nightly news. But then again, there are more members, twice as many members as senators, thanks to the nexus provision of the Constitution. But that's where the constitutional requirements end. The Westminster Convention that Prime Ministers sit in the lower house is largely based on the democratic legitimacy of Britain's elected lower house, even though British Prime Ministers have sat in their unelected upper house. However, both Australian houses are popularly elected, and the Prime Minister isn't even mentioned in our constitution. Senators have also reinforced the convention by switching to the lower house to realise political ambitions. Unlike the United States, where the most common path is from the House to the Senate and the Senate to the presidency, in Australia, senators with the leadership or other ambitions have switched to the House. When Liberal Senator John Gorton became Prime Minister, he resigned from the Senate and contested a lower House seat. Liberal Bronwyn Bishop, Labor Gareth Evans and Democrat turned Labor Party member Cheryl Curnow also switched from the Senate to the House with varying degrees of success. Treasurers have been more willing to challenge the conventions, particularly since the Senate showed that budgets are not sacrosanct and it effectively has the same powers as the House. While budget bills must be introduced into the House of Representatives, the convention that the Treasurer actually has to sit there has been challenged in New South Wales, Victoria and Tasmania in their state parliaments. I don't deny that conventions are hard to change, and that they aren't just as important for the stability of our political system as our written constitution is, but at least our written constitution has precise and transparent mechanisms to change it. Conventions, on the other hand, are often just repeated without understanding that there is a historical context and without recognising that they've actually evolved over time and should continue to evolve. For all the talk of the diminishing importance of our state parliaments and poor performance of some state governments, they have generally been better at recognising that the times are actually changing. When Rob Oakeshott suggested that a Liberal serve in a Labor cabinet or vice versa, he was inevitably ridiculed, but a National has served in a Labor cabinet in South Australia, and there have been a few independent ministers in state cabinets, just as there are now Greens in the Tasmanian cabinet. There are likely to be new precedents in this new parliament, but the House will most probably find that various state parliaments and the Senate have already confronted these questions a long time ago. They may also discover some other exciting innovations. One of the most common areas of Senate envy amongst members was Senate estimates committees, but also the committee system in general. This came through most strongly from parliamentarians who have served in both houses. And also, for most members in general, this was the most dominant perception of the work activity of senators. Members, particularly shadow ministers, revealed that they currently feed questions to their Senate colleagues during estimates hearings via laptops and mobile devices, and would relish the opportunity to question public officials directly. Similarly, it's only ministers in the Senate that generally front these committees, even though there are far more ministers in the House. There have been some unsuccessful attempts to replicate estimates committees in the House, and there are some signs that the new Parliament might be more conducive to another attempt, possibly with some more greater success. But I would go one step further, the radical that I am, and propose that rather than doing similar things in parallel, the same estimates process should involve all parliamentarians. There should be some parliamentary mechanism where all parliamentarians can question any member of the executive. Really, the only other times that senators and members currently interact are in their respective party rooms and the comparatively few joint committees, or in formal situations such as the dining room or the airport or ABC's Q&A televised panel discussion. Imagine Senators Bob Brown, Barnaby Joyce and Nick Xenophon directly questioning Prime Minister Julie Gillard or Treasurer Wayne Swan. These are the sorts of democratic innovations we should be debating, not just banal backwards and forwards on the pairing arrangements of the Speaker. Well, that's Senate envy, but senators have been known to suffer from what could be called representation deprivation syndrome, or a longing for constituents and electorates, or more harshly, for legitimacy. We often hear that the Senate is for the states and the House is for the people. But again, this is only a selective reading of history. Certainly, the decision to transplant and graft the US federal system and its model of a powerful state-based upper house onto quite a different bridge system was a political compromise to placate the smaller states. And sure, the Senate has provided a strong employment base for Tasmanians, perhaps only second to logging. But even the constitutional framers during the conventions of the 1890s acknowledged that politically it wouldn't be contests between states in the Senate, but contests between ideologies. And the voting record shows this very clearly, that debates and divisions have never pitted states against states. Certainly there have been a few issues where non-Labor senators in one particular state have crossed the floor, but nothing so significant as to warrant the description States House. And indeed, suggestions to include the word states in the name of the upper house were explicitly rejected during the constitutional conventions. The more popular conception of the two houses among the parliamentarians surveyed is that the lower house was the House of Government and the upper house was the House of Review, with about two-thirds of both current and former members and senators choosing that distinction, and slightly lower proportions of former members and senators. Not a single current senator chose the House of the People, House of the States distinction. Instead, parliamentarians in both groups observed that with the evolution of the Senate, there is now an expectation within government that the substantial debate and amendments will occur in the Senate and through its committees. However, House debates are not meaningless or ineffectual, as ministers and their officers still follow those closely, take note, and make amendments during or after the Senate process, because this is what's widely seen as being the most efficient way to do things. Contrary to the predictions that the legislative flow will be disrupted, our institutions will evolve to suit the circumstances, and the House will evolve just as the Senate has. One thing that doesn't change in the new Parliament is that the government will have to negotiate with either the opposition or crossbenchers to get its legislation through. It really doesn't matter whether those parliamentarians are in the House or the Senate, and if managed appropriately, it shouldn't result in a longer process, and even if it does, why is this a bad thing? More time, more scrutiny, more consultation, more perspectives does not necessarily lead to no outcomes, but could lead to better outcomes. And I know this is a snidely political comment, but it's not as though Labor in majority was known for action, and rather had a penchant for summits and reviews and talking to anyone but bar other elected parliamentarians. For Labor, there is actually a benefit in having a Green in the House, because the Greens will assume this mystical balance of power in the Senate in July next year, so they can commence negotiations with this one party in the House. And I think they will also have a much less frustrating time negotiating with the independents in the House than with some unnamed senators in the past. As I mentioned earlier, this has been a feature of the Senate for much longer because its proportional representation system better represents the will of the people. putting the equality of states issue to one side, in terms of the national vote shares being translated into the seats, the permutations of Senate seats have been a much more accurate reflection of how people actually voted. The House's electoral system traditionally tends to reward a major party with a much greater share of seats than its vote share. So governments have been governing without majority popular support in terms of primary votes for quite some time, since the 1975 election after the dismissal, in fact, which was the last time a government won more than 50% of the first preference votes. Since then, the majority of Australians have actually voted for the other parties in an election, not the governing party or parties. This election result forces Labor to build majorities that reflect majority support, popular support. At a basic level, the combination of Labor, the Greens, and the three independents who supported Labor in the majority is the majority both in seats and primary votes. Had those independents gone the other way and supported the Liberals, the Nationals, the Liberal Nationals, the Country Liberals, and the West Australian Nationals, and these are all the parties in the coalition, without the Greens and their bloc, it wouldn't have been representative of the majority of primary votes. But again, that's our system, and it would have been a legitimate government too. It's just to provide a different perspective on this vote seat space debate that's been going on. One thing the House will probably never copy from the Senate is the proportional representation election system, as the concept of locally based representation is very strong. In the survey, I asked parliamentarians who or what do they think they primarily represented. About a third of current members chose the defined geographic area, and a further quarter chose the option geographic area through a party or vice versa. Interestingly, this was the same for senators, with just over a quarter choosing the same option, and a third of respondents split between defined geographic area and just party. Notably, not a single member chose just party. This also came through in the interviews, with a stronger sense of local attachment for members and a stronger feeling of being party advocates for senators. This is not particularly surprising, given that in many parties, senators are pre-selected through a much more centralised party process, whereas many pre-selections for seats in the House have some degree of local party involvement. But what was surprising was the almost condescending dismissal of the Senate as a party's house, even though party discipline is just as strong in the House and is used to stifle debate and negotiation, and the even stronger claim that amongst members that the biggest difference is that senators don't have constituents, implicit in which was that members work harder because of this. But senators do have constituencies. They're not just necessarily geographically contained in a defined electorate the way that members' constituents are. Most senators pursue particular policy interests and develop policy expertise, and relationships with key stakeholders within that area become their constituents. It could be unions or an industry or an employer group, farmers, refugee groups, environmental organisations, churches, the list goes on. Senators become key advocates and often become known for pushing certain issues onto the agenda with the freedom that members don't always have. Senators also have more traditional geographic constituencies, with the major parties realising long ago that they could be key campaign agents. Once upon a time, with the exception of Tasmania, senators were based in the Commonwealth parliamentary offices in the central business districts of the capital cities. Over the last few decades, there's been a shift to the suburbs and to the regions. Tasmania has always had a higher degree of geographic spread, but on the mainland, the parties realised, and again I'm putting my cynical academic hat on, that it was a waste to have taxpayer-funded offices hidden away in inner-city high-rises, and they moved to shopfronts in electorates where they did not have lower house representation. It gave them visibility, but less cynically, it also gave constituents more points of contact. And again, senators revealed in the interviews and surveys that constituents would often come to them after trying their local member or a department and perceiving them to be unsympathetic to their concerns. Unlike one local member, if that person happens to hold an ideological position different to your own, there are 12 senators as alternatives, representing a wider range of viewpoints. Parties have now formalised this role, with duty senators allocated a few marginal and opposition-held electorates, and again, the surveys reveal that senators are attending more and more public functions and community events and increasingly becoming well-known, or in some cases better known, than members. many crossbench senators or senators just willing to speak their minds have become national political figures in a way that few non-ministerial members have been able to. Again, like their Senate colleagues before them, crossbench members are developing significant profiles, and many people now know the names Oakeshott, Windsor and Catter. Thus far, I've couched negotiation in largely positive terms, but what about accusations of certain, shall we say, eccentric politicians holding governments to ransom, or hostile senates, or another 1975? And of course, to borrow from Oakeshott, don't mention mandates. Well, of course, the crossbenchers involved negotiated outcomes to the benefit of what they saw as the greater good, and not just the interests of their own electorate. Indeed, the common criticism was that some of them went beyond their own electorate and their immediate electoral interests. Recent experience from the Senate shows that, and once more without mentioning any names, the most troublesome senators have been the ones expelled from a party or elected off a low base with preference deals from other parties. These are problems with our electoral system and candidate selection within parties, rather than the institution of the Senate or the presence of the crossbench. As for hostile senates, there's no such thing. There's representative or democratic senates, so when the government is defeated, it is because a majority of senators representing a majority of people after deliberation vote to defeat legislation. Crossbenchers alone do not have the power to do anything unilaterally. They have to be supported by at least one of the major blocs. And not to get into the 1975 dismissal debate, but if the government does fall, it will be for a good reason. And again, it's a key accountability mechanism in our system. Think the New South Wales government. Need I say more, but the governing party having the power to last until the bitter end is not necessarily a good thing. And so-called stability, or rather longevity, doesn't always lead to good outcomes. But in any case, the chain of events in 1975 was propelled by the major parties and not genuine crossbenchers. Finally, mandates are another political construction that are rarely based on majority opinion. Remember that governing parties rarely win a majority of votes and sometimes don't even win the majority of the two-party preferred vote. So a mandate based on the majority of seats in one house is not the strongest representative claim. After this election, though, neither side is in the position to claim a mandate, which is another positive because mandates are not necessarily the basis of good public policy. The best legislation is legislation that changes as it makes its way through Parliament. That's why we have a Parliament and not a one-party state. Furthermore, each member or senator is elected on their own platform or mandate of sorts and cannot be expected to abandon it. So yes, the opposition has every right to oppose everything, and it always has had that right. The uncertainty in the outcome of legislation shouldn't be something to fear, but something that makes politics more interesting and exciting. Democracy isn't premised on providing certainty. Authoritarian regimes do a much better job at that. Furthermore, majority government doesn't provide the certainty that some commentators like to claim. Without commenting on the merits of the policy, the previous majority government's mining super profits tax is not the product of a certain or predictable process. Majority governments often embrace new policies that they didn't take to an election or abandon elements of their published platforms. I don't want to get into whether that is a good or bad thing, but simply note that these decisions leading to these outcomes are made behind closed doors. One of the recurring themes from members and senators of the major parties was that the best debates actually occur within the party rooms. And one even suggested putting cameras in there. I think these admissions are really concerning. Of course, it's understanding that parties, and indeed voters, don't like public displays of disunity. But the way this has been interpreted means that we are missing out on some of the best policy debates and important information on where our local members really stand on key issues. This new parliament does present an opportunity for more public debates, with proposals for debates on euthanasia and the war in Afghanistan already being mooted. So in conclusion, I don't see this election result, I do see this election result as a first and quite a small step towards positive political change. Just as it has taken the Senate decades to evolve, so too some of the reforms that the House has made will be reversed when a major party takes control again, but some will be consolidated and built upon. I'm not predicting the end of the two major parties, as I think they will still be the dominant players in any alliance or coalition and continue, in effect, to produce the candidates for the Prime Ministership and most of the Cabinet. And while their collective share of the vote has been slowly declining over time, the overwhelming majority of voters still support them, and there have been swings back to them at some recent elections. And the next election will more than likely produce a majority government, as has happened at the state level. But I do predict that voters' attitudes will change. A Senate where one side does not control the numbers has come to be seen as a good thing by a significant proportion of voters. Younger voters in particular are being socialised into a political system where there are more than two choices, and that's where partisan attachment is breaking down most dramatically. But that also brings volatility, and just as easily as there are swings away from one party, there can be a swing back. Nor am I actually against the majors, rather I'm against the artificial two-party system with strong party discipline when there are clearly more than two perspectives in the community and more than one perspective within any party. If a majority of Australians gives their number one vote to one party, then that party should have a majority, but that's not happening. If Australians are simply choosing between two parties, then have a two-party preferred vote. But again, that's changing. The Senate and senators have changed, and now the House and its members will also have to, if it really is the House of Representatives. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Scott. You've provided us with a great deal of food for thought. If anybody has a question, Scott's happy to take questions. I'm having difficulty seeing, but if you'd like to come to the microphones at either side, we have a gentleman on my right. Try it.
Can you hear?
Yes.
The first woman member of the US Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor, now retired, has seen it fit to give prominence in her retirement to the persuasive influence of studying in the curriculum of United States schools, particularly in Washington, D.C., the notion of civics. What you said today and what you exemplified and what the community is showing exemplifies, I think, reasonably the need for a study of in our curriculum, the notion of civics. I wonder if you'd comment on that, and also how to give prominence in a very competitive national curriculum to such an idea, and how to give prominence to it by prominent people taking part.
Yeah, thank you for the comment and the question, and I think previously, former Senator Margaret Reynolds has spoken on exactly that issue in a previous Senate lecture, I think last year, on giving more prominence. And there are moves to do that. I mean, one of the controversies, though, has been how to do that in a nonpartisan way. And that's sort of been where there's been a bit of caution in proceeding. But it is quite clear that we do need to know more about the very basics of that system. And it's not just people in schools, people in universities, or the wider community. I think the biggest group, the most important group that needs to undertake these sorts of courses are our political journalists. I mean, that was what was most shocking in this election commentary. Just very simple, basic questions that they were asking as if there were no answers to, where there are answers. And had they actually done Politics 101, they would know very clearly what those answers were. And they were then contributing to some misinformation and fear within the community. So I think that journalists should be compulsory for political journalists to actually do some very basics for politics. But in a broader sense, absolutely, I do support sort of civics and politics courses in schools. It just has to be designed in such a way that it isn't, I guess, partisan or politically contentious.
Next question.
But you referred to estimates hearings. I was wondering whether the members and the senators to whom you spoke had different views towards their committee activities more generally. And also, do you think there'll be a change in that now that the government doesn't have control of the House?
Yes, thank you. Another very good question, because committees was one thing that came out very strongly in both the interviews and the surveys. There seemed to be a greater sense in the House. I mean, House do have committees, very valuable committees as well. And they actually commented, which I found quite interesting, that they were much more collaborative, much less partisan than the Senate committees actually were. But the flip side to that is because they weren't necessarily dealing with very contentious pieces of legislation. They were actually dealing with pieces of legislation where there generally was bipartisan support. It was just nutting through the details of it. So the two different committee systems have complemented each other very well in that respect. But at the same time, there was a very strong desire amongst members for those estimates, more than anything, those estimates committees. They wanted to be part of it. They wanted to be asking the questions as well in that. So I think there will be moves once more, and there have been moves in the past to introduce estimates committees in the House, but the problem has been because the government has controlled the numbers, they haven't been as effective as they perhaps could be. So I think in this new Parliament there will be moves once again, particularly from those few members who have served in the Senate. I'm thinking here people like Bronwyn Bishop, who would be very keen to see it. She was one of the chief sort of interrogators and really made a name for herself through those estimates committees. But on the other side, I do think the one difficulty, one challenge will be senators can do that because they don't have the same sorts of constituent demands. So they can spend more time away from their home and undertaking those sorts of committees, where it's much more challenging for members to travel the country during non-sittings and where they're doing some more investigative committees. They do that, but it does seem to be much more challenging for them to do that compared to senators.
Now we have a question on my left.
It's better. You were talking about the role of the Senate now being more of a house of review, and that when you interviewed people, they said that it was they saw it as a house of review rather than representing states' rights. So I guess I'm just wondering, given the structure of the Senate and the way that states are represented in the Senate and the way that territories aren't particularly represented in the Senate, how do we move forward reforming the Senate so that Senate it now becomes... You implied it was an evolution. Mm-hmm. How do we move forward on reform of the Senate so the Senate is actually representative of the population as a house of review as opposed to a state's house?
Thank you. I previously sort of looked at this issue, or a few years ago looked at that sort of issue of reform of the Senate, and I think one thing that could be done, I doubt it ever will be for many sort of political reasons, but one thing that could be done is retaining this proportional representation system, but having it based on national vote shares. Now, of course, the smaller states will be up in arms. They don't want to lose representation, etc. But one very simple way of getting around that is you require parties to order their candidates such that they have to select someone from every state and territory in their order of election. So that way you'd still be getting equal numbers from the states into the Senate, but it'll be based on a national vote share. So you couldn't get the situation that we have at the moment, where I think in New South Wales a vote's worth 10 times less than one in Tasmania. By doing that as well, you also bring down those thresholds so you get much more precision in how the votes are translated into seats. So I think that could be a useful way of doing it. The other thing that has actually happened now that we've gone back to a Senate that isn't controlled by one side is committees have been once again reformed. So when the Coalition did win control, they very much reformed the committees to give them more power in those things. So those institutions are also very important.
Could I perhaps add something there,
sure,
Scott?
Yes.
That there are some interesting tables in that well-known work, Odge's Australian Senate Practice, which do actually show how the proportion of people voting for the Senate nationally are very,
very close.
Closely reflected in the actual distribution of seats.
Yes.
I just throw that in.
No, that's a very good point as well. So even without that sort of reform, it's still in effect happening. But, I mean, the other point about the territories, I do have a former resident of the ACT, I think it's an outrage that Territorians don't have the same sorts of vote weight that the citizens in the states do. But, again, it's a political thing. They're not going to increase the number of seats because the Coalition is less likely to win those seats. And there's a partisan advantage there. So I can't see that happening, but really it should be, because as it turns out, Territory residents are actually probably the most politically engaged in the country, yet have the least representation.
Are there any further questions? Yes, you can ask another one. And there's a lady up the back if you'd like to come to the microphone. Go ahead.
I guess the other thing is that minority government's been given a very bad name, I think, in Australia in particular, and yet, as you say, there's minority governments going on around the country. Clearly it's in the major party's interest to demonise minority government. I presume that's why it's got such a bad name, because in actual fact it doesn't produce unstable government. Is that your sense of why that is such a negative agenda around that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the most sort of comical aspects, again, I don't want to be too partisan here, but when, you know, the coalition were going on about this Labor, Greens, Independent Alliance, and you know, all these different views, again, as I mentioned in this speech, the coalition actually consists of multiple different parties because they're different in now Queensland and the Northern Territory. So there were actually five parties in their coalition, and one of them was saying, don't necessarily count me into that. I haven't actually said I'm going to support it. So they are a multi-party coalition in a sense. So why there is this fear of another multi-party coalition getting up is really quite odd. But, I mean, it is a political thing. It is to demonise minority governments to scare people in swinging back and voting for the majors.
Go ahead.
You mentioned the demonising of minority parties. Well, currently, I'm just wondering how amazing it is that in a so-called democracy called Australia, that very little attention is paid to the fact that the press is so biased, and the press belongs to the Media Entertainment Arts Alliance Union, which is traditionally controlled by the Labor Party. And what's amazing that in this democracy, every single interview that you saw on ABC, four-fifths of the interviews, every time they would be interviewing someone from the Liberal Party, that the interviewer methodically, and this goes across the board on every single ABC program, they methodically cut them off. They never let them finish a sentence. They let the Labor candidates stand there and they'll deliver their speech, they deliver their 30 seconds or 40 seconds, whatever it is, and they basically read whatever it is they prepared. And it's just ridiculous. None of those journalists would ever get jobs in America. They are so unprofessional. In America, the journalists, the political journalists are, they're supposed to be diplomatic. None of those people would get jobs at the UN. The UN is the centre of world diplomacy. And I think that the journalists should be absolutely ashamed of themselves, because four-fifths of them are totally unprofessional, and nobody's paying attention to any of that. Nobody's addressing that, and that is really a major issue, because there's something called protocol, there's something called diplomacy, and it's not being followed. And it's something that really touches me in the heart, because I've belonged to that Media Entertainment Arts Alliance Union for 40 years. I've been a member of it. I've spent time in and out of the UN in New York. I used to work at the American Embassy here in Australia. And I know personally that the Labor Party, when it was inconvenient, they didn't support America. They denigrated America. I personally was in New York sitting in a hotel room listening to a senior person in politics in the Labor Party in Sydney, ringing up saying, oh, make sure you do the normal anti-American press. Well, it now suddenly seems to suit, for the last 5 years, it suddenly suits the Labor Party to suddenly be saying, oh, America, America, and suddenly we respect America. Well, they never did previously, and I know that for a fact. And unfortunately, we're experiencing the legacy of Sir Peter Abels, who put Bob Hawke in power in the first place. And all of these things now.
We took that as a comment, and thank you very much for your comment.
You know,
it's hard to find a question in there. But look, unfortunately,
the question is why doesn't anyone say something about the media, and why don't they teach them to be diplomats instead of cutting people off?
Do you want to say anything?
I'm happy to respond to that. I mean, I think the issue of bias is an interesting one, but I don't think you could say that it's all one-sided. So, I mean, you could look at the ABC, but then you could look at the Australian and Sky News, and I think there's bias in all media organisations. But the point I want to make is that, I mean, the research tells us that we as consumers will actually choose the outlets where we agree with them anyway. So the media isn't actually that great at challenging or changing our points of views. It's just it's good at reinforcing our existing points of view. And where we do actually come across sort of conflicting information, we're more likely to disregard it. So I'd be cautious of seeing that as necessarily swaying public opinion in that way. The other point to make is that younger consumers of media aren't actually going to these traditional sources anyway. They're using much more diverse sources of information. So again, when you're talking about the ABC or talking about newspapers, they're not actually reaching out to the masses of voters in the same way that they have done in the past anyway.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up, so I'd like to thank you all for coming today and to thank Scott very much for a highly stimulating lecture. Please join me in thanking Scott Greenfield. And we look forward to seeing you next time. I think next time we're returning to seeing what is happening with parliamentary reform in the UK. Thank you for coming.